If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 234. Today on the Amateur Traveler, we talk about castles and shrines and temples, and of course, sushi, as I talk about my recent trip to Japan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. This episode of the Amateur Traveler is sponsored by Viator. And Viator is a great site for getting tours, day trips, and short excursions for popular destinations. And I just recently took one of their tours in Kyoto, Japan, which you'll hear more about in this episode of the Amateur Traveler. For more about Viator, go to amateurtraveler.com/tours. Before we get into this week's main content, I do have three news stories to share for you. I'm sure that CBS 11 out of Dallas was trying to be helpful when they were announcing that the new Pope was from Argentina when they put up a map of South America marking where Argentina was. The only problem is they marked it as being in Colombia. So here's the quiz. There are only 13 countries in South America. We've covered 12 of them on the Amateur Traveler. So go to Google and Google blank map South America and bring up a blank map of South America and tell me, can you label all 13 countries? In another news story, a Frenchman tried to reenact Catch Me If You Can. He couldn't get a seat in first class, so he went into the cockpit and pretended to be the crew, even dressing the part, and was caught immediately. And the final news story, if you're a fan of Frommer's Guides, if you've ever used a Frommer guide, Frommer's was bought by Google recently, and they are discontinuing the paper publication of all Frommer's guides. So those guides you have in the garage have just become collector's items. Links to all three of those stories, the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I've been meaning to get to this episode for a while. I did a trip to Japan in January that I want to talk about. We've talked about Japan before. We've done a number of different episodes. And so this will cover some of the same ground as those episodes. But if we're going to Japan, I wanted to tell you about my first trip there. My trip was a little unusual because I was going there as a guest of ANA, All Nippon Airways, that was opening up a new route from San Jose, where I live, to Tokyo, Japan, and they wanted me to fly over as part of a press trip there. And the interesting thing about it is they were flying the new 787, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, which you may know is now grounded until they figure out some of the problems with the batteries that came up on a flight from ANA. ANA actually has the biggest fleet of Dreamliners in the world at this time. And that happened while we were in Japan. So I was over there to promote this new route, and the new route is currently on hold until they figure out the problems. And the reason for that is that this plane lets them open up routes that they wouldn't otherwise have because it's more efficient. I do hope they fix the problems of the plane, because actually the Dreamliner itself was a real interesting ride. Bigger windows. The cabin is actually more humid because the fuselage of the plane is made of composite materials and not metal, so they don't have to worry about metal corrosion and they can keep the humidity higher. As I said, I was on a press trip, and it was amazing how giddy a bunch of travel writers and airplane writers got about the plane. So hoping they bring that back soon. I think they're very close to bringing that back. So we flew into Tokyo, and Tokyo obviously being the capital of Japan, it's really the new capital or the northern capital, and that's really what the name means, is northern capital, Tokyo. And we did some things relative to the press trip that you wouldn't get a chance to do, like seeing the maintenance facility for ANA, but we also saw some of the traditional sites while I was still on the press trip. We went up in the Tokyo Tower, one of two towers that's in Tokyo. This is the one that's the replica of the Eiffel Tower, except orange. We did not go up in the new Skytree Tower, which is even taller. We saw the Imperial Palace grounds, but only from the outside, and walked around them in the rain. I happened to be in Tokyo during a freak snowstorm. Tokyo doesn't get a lot of snow. And we are right in the middle of our visit of the Sensoji Temple in Asakusa, one of the districts of Tokyo, when the freezing rain turned to snow. And oddly enough, that may have been the visit where I fell in love with Tokyo. Tokyo covered with snow is a more beautiful city than Tokyo in the freezing rain, and not surprisingly enough. One snowy day activity that I enjoyed, when all of the rest of the press trip went back to the hotel because it was snowing, my fellow blogger and I, Amy O'Shaughnessy from Ciao Bambino, went to the Edo Museum. And Edo is the old name of Tokyo. Before the emperor moved north to Tokyo, it was known as Edo. And this is a museum, the Edo Museum, about the history of that city and how it was in the shogunate time, and then how it changed very radically when the country started to modernize. I enjoyed the museum. It was a good hands-on museum if you had kids as well, although for us it was a particularly good snowy day activity. Although one interesting surprise was that the trains actually, because of the snow, and they're not used to snow in Tokyo, stopped running, and so it did get a little hard to get back to our hotel. A couple surprises for me about Tokyo. I'd heard that Japan in general and Tokyo specifically were a very expensive country, and I was surprised to find that I really didn't find that to be my experience. Now, I was there in the winter when the hotel rates were cheaper, and I would really recommend more April timeframe. I would recommend when the cherry blossoms are out or that time of year instead of the heat of the summer or the cold of the winter. And my hotel room that ANA put us up in, which was a 5-star hotel, the Capital Hotel chain, was an expensive hotel and a very, very nice hotel. But when I came back on my own, I was able to find hotel rooms for about $50 that were very nice, that were small, but they were very pleasant. So I really didn't find it to be that expensive. I could go out for dinner and eat a rice bowl or something, and something like a Yoshinoya for less than $5 US. So it really wasn't that expensive if you didn't want it to be that expensive. Now, on the other hand, when ANA took me out for sushi, I think that was more than $50 per person, but it was a very fancy restaurant, a very good sushi, if you happen to like sushi. So that was a surprise. Tokyo, very big city, but very clean, obviously very crowded, but the transportation system runs very well. A couple of interesting areas that I saw when I came back again to the city on the tail end of my trip is I did get to the Electric Town, and we mentioned on the previous episode, which goes into more detail about Tokyo, about things like maid bars, where you can maybe pay twice as much for dinner, but be called master all night long by somebody in a frilly short skirt. An odd idea, but you can see those in Akihabara, which is the other name for the Electric Town. Also, if you're a big fan of any of the Japanese manga or the Japanese animation, anime, that all comes from Akihabara, from Electric Town. And so you're going to want to do a pilgrimage to there if that is something that you really enjoy. And then I also did get to Shibuya, which is what you often see in movies, that looks like Tokyo's version of Times Square with people just everywhere. And especially the one intersection where they turn the lights green and everybody goes in all directions, you can see how crowded the city is. And that's where some of the nightlife is for Tokyo as well. But what I really want to focus on for this episode of The Amateur Traveler was that after the press trip ended, and press trips are interesting because somebody is paying for you, but you get to see what they want you to see, but not necessarily what you're wanting to see. So I tacked on some extra time to go out and see some of the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Japan, especially outside of Tokyo. So I got a Japanese rail pass, and you can do that before you leave the US for relatively inexpensive. It was over $300 for a week, but I used it quite a lot. And I'm going to describe to you a less than week long itinerary. I started on Wednesday and I flew out again on Monday that covers way more ground than I would recommend that you cover in that period of time. Just so you know, when I'm traveling by myself all alone, I travel at about twice the pace that I would if I were traveling with my family. So think of this about 10 days worth of itinerary crammed into about five. But I got on the Shinkansen, which is the high-speed train, which is wonderful. I really did enjoy it. If I'd had more time, it might have been more economical to do some of the short-term flights on ANA or one of the other local carriers. But with a real compact itinerary and way too many places to see, it made more sense to get the rail pass. With the Shinkansen, it's interesting. You just walk up, and there's always the next train. There's quite a few of them going on. So I took the high-speed train down to the ancient capital of Kyoto. Kyoto and Nara were both capitals of Japan before Tokyo. And while I was there, I did a tour that was arranged by Viator that was an all-day tour of both some of the sites of Kyoto, and then we drove over to Nara as well. And the sites that we saw were some of the best-known sites in Kyoto. We started in Nijo Castle, and Nijo Castle was the castle built by the founder of the Tokugawa shogunate. And if you're not familiar with the shogun, then you clearly haven't read the novel by James Clavell of the same name. But the shogun was the one who basically conquered all of Japan and united it into one country in the 1600s. And the Tokugawa family ruled the shogunate, ruled as shoguns until the end of the 1800s. And this castle was one of only 8 castles left in Japan. There used to be 150 from the feudalistic times of Japan. And remember, the feudal times of Japan lasted into the 1800s, and so that isn't all that long ago. But a lot of the castles, the buildings were built of wood, and so quite a lot of them have burned down. And that's true of a lot of the temples that you'll see in Japan as well, including one that I'll get to. But the castle is very interesting because it gives you a little peek into the culture at that time. I had a guided tour through the castle again, and the castle is a fairly sparse building because all of the furniture would be put away at night. This is a very Japanese-style room with the rice mats, and if there were tables, they'd be the low tables that would come in and go out, and if there were beds, they would be the futons that would come in for the night and then would be taken away during the day. And they had dioramas of the shogun with the other nobles coming to him, only able to carry their short sword that was a sign of their office, not able to carry the big, long samurai sword for safety reasons, obviously safety of the shogun. And there were lovely gardens in the castle as well, which were worth exploring, that the shogun could look out on when he was hard at work. We went from there to the Imperial Palace. You can tour the Imperial Palace, but unlike the Nijo Castle, you can't go into the buildings. So you kind of tour around the outside. During the period of the shogunate, the emperor was probably more of a figurehead, at least that's how we would see it. I'm not sure that all the Japanese would see it that way, because they definitely trace the current emperors of having ruled for centuries. That's one of the reasons why the capital moves up to Tokyo, is that the emperor stays in Kyoto, then all the real power moves up to Tokyo until after the restoration of the emperor into power under Meiji, which happens in the late 1800s, and then he also moves to Tokyo as well. But they're still keeping the palace in Kyoto, and they're ready for him to move back at any time, but I don't think it's going to happen. One of the reasons why the emperor moved is, as they wanted to modernize Japan, a lot of the old noble families that had a lot of control and weren't so favored and weren't fans of modernization were in the Kyoto area, and it was easier to leave them behind. After the Imperial Palace, we also went to the Golden Pavilion, which I'm sure you've seen pictures of, which is this beautiful gold Buddhist temple. And it was first an imperial residence by a retired shogun of the Tokugawa shogunate, and then later became a Buddhist temple. What you're actually seeing when you see it, unfortunately, is a replica, because it burned down in the 1800s because a disgruntled Buddhist monk burned it down. But it's a beautiful building sitting behind a reflecting pond, and probably one of the most photographed buildings in all of Japan, let alone in Kyoto. And after we saw that, we went over to Nara. And in Nara, there are a couple of big things. And Nara is, again, the capital before Kyoto, and it was limited because of its location and the amount of water into a certain population. And that's why the capital moved away. And Kyoto is a bigger city, big enough that I actually got lost going around Kyoto, which is very rare for me. But I had thought I was by one park, and I was really by another. But I was befriended by an American expat and his Japanese wife, a musician who lives there, who threw me in their car and drove me to my hotel when I was miles away from where I thought I was. Nara is a smaller town, and we went to Nara to see two things. One is the giant Buddha. And the giant Buddha is at Todaiji, and this is a Buddhist temple complex in Nara that is the largest wooden building in the world. And inside this wooden building is this great big metal Buddha. And the first thing you notice when you get to the grounds in Nara is deer everywhere. And the reason there are deer everywhere is that they are sacred in Nara, and you are not allowed to disturb them. And they are allowed to disturb the tourists, though. If you do decide to get some food to feed the deer, you should know that they believe that they are in charge of Nara, and they can get a little insistent if you walk away and they think you are not done feeding them. And the Todaiji Temple, as well as the three things that I mentioned in Kyoto already, are all UNESCO World Heritage Sites. In addition to that, we went to a Shinto shrine. And in Japan, there is this interesting combination of Buddhist temples and Shinto shrines. And when people ask what religion people are in Japan, it's a little confusing because it's not like they are 50% Shinto and 50% Buddhist. It's more like they are 80% Shinto and 80% Buddhist, because many people adopt both beliefs and they tend to use Shinto and shrines to a million different gods, a million different spirits as for their daily life. And then they tend to use Buddhism with its understanding of life after for death. And so you might be buried at a Buddhist temple, but go to a Shinto shrine when you need luck for that particular exam. In fact, in Kyoto, we passed by the shrine that the students go to for luck for passing the high school examinations. But we went to a Shinto shrine, the Kasuga Grand Shrine in Nara, which is probably the most beautiful of all the shrines that I saw, in my opinion, in Japan. And one of the reasons for that is not the shrine itself, but on the way up, there are a number of stone lanterns that are moss-covered that they put lanterns in, they put lights in during major festivals that were quite beautiful, quite photogenic. And speaking of photogenic, the other shrine that I saw in Kyoto before I left was the Fushimi Inari Taisha Shrine, or the Fox Shrine, which has a number of the torii. And the torii are the golden-colored gates. And the purpose of the torii is that walking through the gates is supposed to purify you. And if you were really impure, you'd want to go to the Fox Shrine, because there's just torii after torii after torii in this, almost in an orange tunnel. And as I pronounce the Japanese words, I should say that I was getting around Japanese, and I think I really know basically about two words of Japanese. I know how to say hello, and I know how to say thank you. I tried to learn more, but I kept getting distracted by other things. So it really isn't that hard to get around, although there were occasionally odd moments, like trying to navigate some of the subway systems. Kyoto and Tokyo both have subway systems, where it was helpful actually to know Chinese characters, because I could recognize that that was an adult ticket, because that was the Chinese character, which got adopted as a Japanese character for a big person instead of a little person, but really not too difficult to get around with English only, although certainly easier if you knew some Japanese. From Kyoto, I headed north. I stopped briefly in Hakone, Japan, and Hakone, Japan has one of those other eight castles, which I explored up in the snow. I walked up to the castle. When I say castles, these are relatively small castles. There are some bigger ones. The Matsumune Castle in Nagano and the Osaka Castle are probably the largest. Osaka is actually undergoing reservation, so I didn't bother going down there because all I would see was scaffolding, and I didn't get up to Nagano in this trip, just too far. But I did enjoy exploring this castle. But we're talking about something that's basically a four-story building or so, three or four-story building, so it's not really all that large when we use the word castle. And the same is true with the Nijo Castle in Kyoto. And then I was on my way further north, and I was on my way up to Nikko. And Nikko, they say, is the spiritual heart of Japan. And one of the reasons for that is a number, again, of important temples and shrines. Particularly the temple you go up to Nikko to see is the one that was founded by, again, the founder of the first shogun there in the 1600s. And it's where he is buried. It is a very elaborate temple. And that's the Toshogu Temple. And probably the best known thing about the Toshogu Temple is a very small decorative piece that shows three monkeys doing see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil. A small and minor piece of the entire temple complex, which is quite elaborate and quite large, but it is possibly the most photographed piece of that whole temple complex. And again, that is part of a larger complex of a number of temples and shrines in that area, which are worth visiting, and all are part of, again, of another UNESCO World Heritage site. And while I'm talking about Nikko, I want to mention hospitality, because I ran into somebody on the streets of Nikko who was just sweeping up. There's always somebody sweeping up. It's a very clean country, who was practicing his English. So he said good morning to me, and I greeted him as well. And then I went and explored a number of these different temples in Nikko. And Nikko is a very small town. And as I came back down, I ran into him again. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I was going to find lunch." And he said, "Well, what are you looking for?" And he said, "Do you want noodles? Because you can't throw a stone without hitting a noodle place in Japan." And I said, "No, I was actually looking for a rice bowl." He puzzled. Rice bowl. And then he started walking away and motioned for me to follow him. So I followed him, and he got in his car and motioned me to get in. So I got in his car and he drove me across town. It's a small town, and pulled into a 7-Eleven or the equivalent. There are 7-Elevens there. I don't remember which this was, and took me into the back, and there were rice balls. So we had a little trouble with translation, but I figured at that point, when someone has been that generous with their time, I was going to get a rice ball, and actually it was pretty good. But that did point out to me some of the hospitality of the people. And the interesting thing about being in Japan is how you can be there for a week and you're still bowing to people, and it still would feel right to you to bow to people when you get back. There's just, it's so built into the culture in terms of this politeness. And certainly it's in part because of the density of the population. I know Japan is like half the population of the U.S. in an area the size of California, so roughly five times the population of California in an area the same size. But it's something that I did get used to. I did enjoy the civility and the politeness of the culture. And especially as someone who really wasn't speaking a lot of English, it's nice when you can just smile and bow. And the last stop I want to mention, which I went again, and you'll see the theme here, it was to Kamakura, Japan. And Kamakura is very near Tokyo. You can just take a local train to get there. And again, a number of shrines and temples and UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And one of the reasons that I'm visiting a lot of UNESCO World Heritage Sites is, in my opinion, a lot of what is old in Japan is very beautiful, and a lot of what is new in Japan is also very beautiful. The modern and those sort of things are quite striking. In between, you can see that there were some hard times, obviously World War II and the aftermath, and so there's a lot of gray and nondescript from sort of the 1950s and 60s, which is not very beautiful. And so for me, what drew me was a lot of these older places. And specifically in Kamakura, there were three places that I think are worth mentioning. One is, again, a giant Buddha. And the great Buddha of Kamakura is different because it used to be an indoor statue, but the building that surrounded it, unlike the largest wooden building in the world down in Nara, has burned down twice. And so now it has been outdoors. It is weathered and green because it has been outdoors since the 1600s, but a very popular site. The second stop I enjoyed was the Zeniare Benten Shrine, and that is a Shinto shrine. And one of the odd things about that, one of the interesting things about that, is people go there and they wash their money. You go into a hole in the rock to get to the shrine, and there is a mountain spring in the shrine where people believe that if they wash their money, it will be multiplied. If you wash 1,000 yen, it'll somehow turn over the course of the year into many thousand yen. And so there's quite a few people there who are washing their coins or washing their paper money in this springs from this water, and then who are drying it over the fires that are lit with incense in this temple. And the temple is filled with people and it's filled with incense, and it's just an interesting experience to go to. And the third place I particularly enjoyed was another temple, and it was the Hokokuji Temple, and that is known for its bamboo grove, and I really wanted to see a bamboo grove. This one is much more out of the way. I walked all the way there. It might be faster to take a bus, or if you had a rental car, to go there or to rent bikes. There was quite a lot of traffic, actually, as I walked back about rush hour during the day. I was walking faster than the traffic, so it is a little less convenient to get to. The one thing that I liked about Kamakura is that they had excellent maps. As you got off the train, there is a tourism office there, and they had wonderful maps that told you how to get to these various sites, and there's quite a few temples there, quite a few shrines, and then it is also on the coast, and so there are beaches there that you could go there if you weren't in winter, as I was. One of the interesting things is, as you're in the town, is as you're walking uphill to get to some of these temples, there are the signs that give you what the elevation is in case of a tsunami, which was sobering in light of what has happened recently in Japan. when I think of the question of one thing that makes you laugh when you think about Japan, I think of the vending machines. And I had heard about the vending machine culture, but it was a little different than I realized. For one thing, almost all the vending machines I saw only held liquids. Now, liquids might be a soda, but they also might be hot soup, or they might be a hot milk tea, which is one of the things I enjoyed, or a hot lemonade. So there are both hot and cold things in the same vending machine. Fortunately, the cold one's labeled in blue typically, and the hot one's labeled in red. But for instance, when I stayed in Nikko, I stayed right near the Kanmanja Fuchi Abyss. And this was a river gorge where you were out near a park. And so we were in almost the last building in town before you got into this very picturesque park. And one of the reasons it's picturesque is there's a whole row of Buddhas that are wearing these interesting red bibs, which I thought was interesting photographically. But anyway, I stayed at a ryokan. A ryokan is a bed and breakfast or a Japanese style inn. I actually chose a Japanese style room. And that meant that I again had the rice mats on the ground and then a futon that I was sleeping on, and then a kerosene heater to keep the room warm. There was also a hot bath elsewhere in the hotel that you could enjoy. And so this building is outside of town. It's out in the middle of nowhere in Nikko, which is itself a small town, but there is in front of it a vending machine. And if you're standing at that vending machine, you can always see another vending machine a few doors down. And so it's interesting to see how ubiquitous they are. And yet almost never, I saw one vending machine the whole time that had snacks. Everything is almost always liquids. And then I saw some vending machines that had cigarettes, and that was pretty much it. There is also, in terms of vending machine culture, when you go to a noodle bar, which I didn't do while I was there, or I tried to once, you have these vending machines out front where you can take a ticket that will determine what kind of noodles you get. Unfortunately, all the writing was in Japanese, and so I had no idea which was which. And I like some of the food in Japan, and because they eat a lot of seafood, not all of it, and so I wasn't just going to pick a ticket at random and then walk up and see that. And my Chinese characters are a little rusty, and so I wasn't able to figure out exactly what I would get. So that's one thing that makes me laugh in Japan. When I think about the best day of my trip, the two spots that I particularly enjoyed were Nikko and exploring this pretty small town there. And I went into the city at night. I had no place to stay lined up and was able to use a Wi-Fi card that I'd been lent by XCOM Global to just sit there in the train station and look for a hotel room. I would suggest if you're there in a busy time of year, you don't do what I did there. But I enjoyed exploring that small town there. But probably my favorite spot, more so even than Tokyo, more so even than Nara or than Kyoto, was Kamakura. And Kamakura, because it is a pretty city there on the coast and had so much interesting things to see in the temples and the shrines, but it just seemed like this is a place where I could picture staying. It drew me more than the big cities did, more than Tokyo or Kyoto. But I'd say, in general, the whole country of Japan, I am surprised how much I enjoyed it. It hadn't been high on my list, to be honest. I'm a big fan of history, as you know, and more aware of European history, and so more drawn to Europe than I am to Asia. And Japan hadn't been on my list because I thought it was too expensive, and it didn't turn out to be. It wasn't on my list because I didn't know the history as well. I know it better now. And it wasn't on my list because of the food. And the food was a little bit of an issue because I'm not a big seafood fan. If you are, Japan is definitely the country for you because there's lots of wonderful seafood. Even I, who don't like seafood, could appreciate the quality of the sushi we had when we were eating at an expensive and wonderful sushi restaurant, but it didn't turn me into a sushi lover. In terms of when did I feel closest and when did I feel furthest from home, a lot of Japan is very familiar and very comfortable. Probably the most exotic to me is standing in a Shinto shrine, because it's a very different thing from where I come from, and especially the shrine that I mentioned in Kamakura, where they're laundering money and there's the smell of incense everywhere and the crowds. It's just very different. It's very different from what I am familiar with. One of the other interesting things about Japan is, at times, I'm going through all of these ancient temples, and you get to sense for how old the culture is. Not just how old the country is, but the culture has this kind of unbroken connection to its ancient history. And then at the other times, you feel like Japan is slightly in the future compared to the rest of us, and certainly the toilets. And we've talked about these before, but once you have the power dry setting on your toilet, you're really looking at something very, very different. And then, of course, when you're in downtown Tokyo, amongst the skyscrapers and amongst the new technology there, it really does feel like a city that's slightly ahead of us, that's slightly there in the future, as in an electric town and places like that. I want to go back to Japan. And I'm a little surprised because I didn't know that I would enjoy it as much as I did, but I want to go back and I want to take my wife. And I'd like to see more of it. I'd like to see more of the countryside. I'd like to see more of the cities. I really did thoroughly enjoy it, and I can highly recommend it. If I have to summarize Japan in three words, and since I make everybody else do it, it's only fair that I do it as well, I would find myself using ancient, futuristic, and gracious. And I think of all of the ancient sites that I saw, and I think of all of the technology and the future sites that I saw. The Shinkansen is amazing. The wonderful experience. I wish we had something like it here in the U.S. And then I also just think about the way that I was treated by clerks and desk clerks and strangers and the gracious hospitality, but also the bowing and that sort of deferential nature, which was a wonderful experience. That was Japan. That was my trip. My thanks to ANA, All Nippon Airways, for the wonderful opportunity. My thanks to Viator, who again sponsored me on that trip down in Kyoto, as well as to XCOM Global, who gave me the Wi-Fi device that I was able to use to keep in touch, which turned out to be very fortunate because, unfortunately, while I was there, my mother-in-law got very sick, and so it became even more necessary to communicate back with home than I had anticipated. The only place that didn't work really was on the high-speed train because you're traveling just way darn too fast. But thanks to all of those for a wonderful trip to Japan. In news of the community, I heard a while back from Joe, who said, I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed both parts of the London show. As a frequent visitor of London, I thought the guest was spot on with all our information. In January, I took my 10-year-old son to London for his first visit. We ate several meals at Pizza Express after downloading coupons, which were recommended by the guest. It's these kinds of kernels of information which are so valuable that you can't find on other travel podcasts. Thanks, Joe. And Joe, I'm glad you are finding some value in the Amateur Traveler. I was cleaning out some of my older emails that I hadn't responded to, but I'd always meant to, and I came across this one from Barbara. And Barbara is from Australia and says, it was with some apprehension that I listened to your podcast recently, as I've previously found American radio to be rather more nonsense than information. Not so with yours, I'm glad to say. Now that I've found you, I'm keen to listen to lots more on my iPod as I do my daily walk. My initial choice was David Grenowetsky's first trip to India, which I thought was great. Then I managed to find one on Burma. Yippee. Now that the country is opening up, I'm sure there will be plenty of people who are keen to travel there. I'm planning a trip to Burma in November. Now, that would have been past November because this is an older email, and have listened to the one episode I found on that country. However, there is plenty of scope for another program visiting different places and perhaps give more detail about getting around and other things to do in the cities, particularly for a traveler who isn't on a guided tour. I'd like to hear from someone who's been on the Irrawaddy River boat between Mandalay and Bagan, and also the slow train in the hills between Kalau and Inlay Lake, perhaps the caves at Pindaya, also the pitfalls of finding a suitable budget guest house and things like that. I really like all those little tips that are so important. For instance, are the boats on the Inlay Lake likely to tip over and ruin my good camera? How can I tell if the cheap hotel has bedbugs? What drinking options are available if the water is dodgy? And most people love to hear about the food of any country. While traveling to a very poor country, it's good to know the little gifts the villagers would appreciate from an affluent country. I believe the Burmese children would love to receive papers and pencils, which they can't afford. In Bali, I found the poor women wanted my lipstick. And Barbara, sorry that I lost this email, first of all. And I hope you did enjoy the show that we did recently on Burma, even though it was probably after you got back. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. Remember, if you're interested in tours from Viator, go to amateurtraveler.com/tours. You can leave a comment in this episode at amateurtraveler.com or send me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can follow me on Twitter @Chris2X. And if you love this show, you can always leave a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, thanks so much for listening.